Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, coming at you once again for part 4 of the Delphi Murders. In this episode, we're going to talk a little bit more about the crossing on the bridge and the transition from there down the hill and so forth. So let's just jump into that right now. And what we see as the girls move down the bridge is two differing types of behavior from Libby and Abby. Libby is out in front, hands on her phone, taking photos, and moving with enough anticipation that Abby remains behind, and she arrives first. Abby, however, seems to be walking with her head down. Even when being photographed, she has her hands in her pockets and is moving at a deliberate pace. It's not difficult to see, all factors considered, that there is greater desire on Libby's part to reach the end of the bridge in a hasty fashion. I don't believe that is simply because she's been there before and has crossed it. I believe it's because she is anticipating something waiting for her at the end and is in a good mood. Abby, on the other hand, would be attending as a buffer, so to speak, a necessary centerpiece to go between her and the guy they were supposed to meet. It's just a layer of protection. So we see in her behavior that there isn't the same level of excitement or nervous energy. She's content to remain at the rear, choosing to indulge the safety of moving at a slower pace. Of course, think of that emotionally now, right? If Libby is the one who potentially got catfished, then she is the one who is not indulging those behaviors because she doesn't have a phone and doesn't have ease of access to people online. And, of course, that means she's moving at a slower pace emotionally. Now, look what nature does to accommodate the structural necessity. If somebody was waiting for them at the end, meaning the end of the bridge, then Abby being behind Libby and arriving second wouldn't put her between the two as a buffer or transcendence point. However, since we know it's the devil coming from the past behind them and not the Father, so to speak, or God, waiting at the end ahead, Abby is placed behind Libby so that she really does end up as a buffer between the two. It's a structural necessity. When Bridge Guy approaches Libby waiting at the end of the bridge, Abby is between them. Now, because the buffer is a transcendence point, like a womb or purgatory, it means the purpose of the buffer is a short-term barrier between two things, meaning one world and the next. But in this case, defined as two people, meaning Bridge Guy and Libby. The buffer is only supposed to remain until she's no longer needed. For instance, and this is a completely ridiculous story, but I think it's totally relevant, so I'm going to tell it. When I was in 7th grade, maybe aged 13, I took a liking to this really pretty girl in my class. She found out that I was a little more interesting than a lot of the other boys, and so she spent a lot of time talking to me, and seemed to be like really enthralled by what I said. So I developed a crush on her, but couldn't bring myself to do anything about it because I was so caught up in the shame of realizing that I was just so much less attractive than she was. But I really liked her, and knew I couldn't just remain silent. I wanted her to know. Still, I was too scared. Back then, you did something called asking a girl out, which meant if you asked, "Will you go out with me?" and she said yes, you were a couple moving forward. So I wanted to ask her to go out with me, but didn't have the courage. Where I specifically lacked the courage is in meeting her with the truth. I was unable to cross that bridge to the other side to make that connection. So I decided to get a buffer to put in between us for safety. The bridge in question I was trying to cross, or the connection I was trying to make, was a phone call to her one night in which I'd ask her to be my girl. So the plan was to get my friend between her and me, meaning have him make the call and ask for me, and if she said yes, we would remove the buffer now that I was safe from getting hurt, and proceed from there. But if she said no and hurt me, the buffer would be there to protect me, to limit my exposure in the sense that a no meant the buffer would remain. I chose my best friend as the person to undertake this delicate task. Now, the plot twist is that he did make the call, yet it was late enough at night that her dad didn't allow her to get on the phone. Afterward, I breathed a sigh of relief because I was so scared of the rejection, and afterward, never asked her out. The buffer stayed between us, and we moved on for one simple reason. I was too immature to handle the situation. And so Libby, in this situation, is seemingly utilizing her buffer for the same reason, as emotional protection from something she might not be able to handle that is going to hurt her. Yet, the big problem here is that this is a physical meeting. 13-year-old Abby, who looks like she weighs 100 pounds soaking wet, isn't much in the way of physical protection as the buffer. And that's the folly involved of manifesting tragic fate. All of the emotional values are corrupted to indulge physicality instead. So as a matter of construction, Libby needed a buffer for physical protection instead of emotional, as we saw in my phone call. When I made that choice to use a buffer, it was due to an emotional deficiency I came to realize I could only overcome with maturity, and decided, due to that, to not proceed because I could potentially get hurt. But you know who proceeds in those situations? People who are hurting so much, they can't see the danger. I knew, deep in my heart, that this girl was too pretty for me. It didn't matter if it was true. If I believed it, then I needed to mature and get past that. And yes, I went on to learn she wasn't out of my league and that other such opportunities would come my way. But it happened when I crossed that bridge emotionally over time to a place of understanding. That's when I finally understood why a girl so much more physically attractive than I was would want anything to do with me. It was because of the things inside that I had to offer. Like Libby, I knew those things were within me and wanted people to look beyond my exterior to see that beauty waiting. But I only knew that was the right path because I matured to that place emotionally. It seems, although we don't know in this case, that she indulged that danger physically by literally crossing a bridge. So the death being risked isn't an emotional one as it might have been in my phone call if I got rejected. This time, it literally means death. Undoubtedly, the perpetrator was that type of kid at her age as well. Someone physically and emotionally similar who wanted to be loved for what's inside. And what makes that concept so poignant for an abused child like our perpetrator most likely is that the idea of what's inside has dual meaning. When you aren't pretty on the outside, you feel like your beauty inside is being silenced, prevented from escaping, and that theme is running beneath the silence, darkness, and ignorance afforded by having an abuser in the home. That secret of having beauty inside of you that wants to get out of a terrible place matches what was going on at home for an abused child in his youth. I remember going to school at this age and feeling as though my mother's alcoholism followed me there, but I wasn't allowed to tell anyone of its presence because it was a secret. I just had to suffer in the silence of everyone else's ignorance. And I think that's how the abused feel as well. And it led to desperately wanting everyone to know what was inside me. I see that desperation very clearly, both in Libby's tie-dyed shirts and her actions. Make no mistake, when Bridge Guy arrives with the implied notion of quote-unquote, this is what I really look like, that is the manifestation of the fear Libby is experiencing in relation to herself. She, too, is afraid she'll finally be exposed for what she really looks like in person. I mean, let's get real. Pictures on the internet are manipulated in various ways in a desperate effort to extract ugliness of any kind. It's the elephant in the room on social media. From angles to filters, people are desperate to not be ugly. She's worried that he's not going to accept her for what she looks like, while, ironically, the truth is that she isn't going to be able to accept him for what he looks like. That is manifesting ironic, tragic fate. When identical emotional worlds collide, they produce physical symmetry, which is why the perpetrator often picks someone like him. If they're suffering the same emotional problem and both manifesting a physical solution, then their narratives will align perfectly. They'll meet. That is how you get the convergence. Men like this know what these kids want to hear because it's what they wanted to hear when they were those kids. Those men know the greatest desires of those kids because, again, they were once them. They know their secrets. And what happens is the child ends up feeling understood by that predator. It's like, he actually gets it. He knows who I am. And that can be so alluring because they're starved for the attention. They're starved for understanding. But there's a sociopathic narcissist on the other end of that hook holding the fishing rod. That predator or pedophile both loves and hates the child they've chosen. That's how we're going to get the wrath and mercy. They suffered in their youth for being like that person and have projected themselves onto that child. So what that allows the self-loathing narcissist to do is physically humiliate, beat, torture, and kill the child he's targeting as revenge for what he suffered and still does because the child haunts his mind. But once that child is dead as a result of his wrath, the narcissist enters the mercy phase in which empathy and shame become evident in the narrative. What they really want is for the child inside them to finally die. So once it happens physically outside, at the crime scene, temporarily taking away the pain of the emotional issues from the past, just like the effect of using drugs, all of the rage dissipates, and in that void, shame, guilt, and empathy emerge. That's the point of putting themselves in the role of the father who abused them. They get revenge by playing that role, but also, after the murder, in typical narcissistic fashion, they believe that showing empathy and feeling guilt and shame are indications of emotional change. They've grown up. So they leave the crime scene, as our perpetrator does here, free of the child, both physically and emotionally. And then we have unity brought from disunity, but through physical means. And again, there is no way to transcend through physicality that is not precipitated by emotional change. Let's quickly look at a scene from The Godfather, because, you know, every philosophical answer you need in life is truly in that movie. When the Godfather, or the father of the family, Marlon Brando, as Vito Corleone, is shot and wants to hand over the reins of his empire to Sonny, his eldest son, the problem is that Sonny is a major hothead. He solves everything with physicality. And it worries his father because his son's emotional evolution hasn't been sufficient to take on the role of the godfather he now suddenly has to take on in his dad's absence. He needs to transcend, to become the father. But he never changes emotionally, and so we know in the story, at the point of no return, or midpoint, Sonny has to die a physical death at a physical transcendence point because he only uses physicality. He does not mature emotionally. He uses fists, guns, threats, and similar. So, as we understand the construction of your physical reality is just a mirrored version of your emotional world painted in symbolic resonance on a visual canvas, the story that needs to be told in images here is that Sonny can't transcend to being the father, and this is, in fact, a tragedy because he refuses to change. So, in the film, at the midpoint, Sonny drives up to a toll booth, or physical transcendence point, and the car in front of him stops so that it's blocking him, suggesting he's stuck here emotionally. He hands the guy working the toll booth cash, a single bill, and just look what it is that he's waiting to receive. Change. But physical change. And because he didn't change emotionally, it never comes. He dies emotionally at the transcendence point between being the father and the son, aka the toll booth, because he refused to change. So here, he's assassinated by gunmen who ironically employ his brand of over-the-top violence and is refused his change. He never gets it. The car stopped in front of him symbolically says he can't go forward, and so he dies there. The inability to go forward was an emotional one, and so it manifests in Sonny physically dying at the transcendence point, unable to move forward. And what we see very clearly in this scene is that there's nobody blocking him from physically turning around and going back to the past, so to speak. There's a car blocking his path forward, but nothing behind him. Due to the fact he refrains from doing it, meaning turning around, going back to the past, and making things right emotionally before moving ahead, he dies due to that unwillingness to change. So when the toll collector takes his money, that emotional value is mirrored at him with physicality in the form of the toll collector offering him no change. That is how your physical world is constructed. It is a mirror for your emotional world because the emotions, meaning the emotional movement of the vibratory symphony, is what comprises your life. You think of the visual events as dictating the substance of your life and what it means, but those images are merely supporting emotional movement, vibration, up and down, over and over again, seeking balance. At the midpoint of Jaws, Chief Brody is afraid the shark is going to kill his son, preventing transcendence from being the son to becoming the father. His fear of going out onto the water, or the dark waters of the unconscious mind, and facing what lies beneath them, is the emotional issue he needs to defeat. The shark coming up to attack him is the equivalent of the child inside this perpetrator's unconscious mind suddenly rising from those dark waters of the past and attacking him emotionally, tearing him apart, limb by limb. We all live in fear of these attacks. But those who have suffered too greatly to deal with it emotionally and need catharsis in the absence of the emotional ability sometimes resort to murder. They don't symbolically kill the giant shark by facing their fears of what lies below in the dark waters of their unrealized emotional worlds. They just keep getting eaten by it over and over again. So instead, to counterbalance that, they feed other people to the shark to compensate, to restore balance as revenge for the attacks on them. That's how the sociopath behaves. But when you behave like this, it's often the type of thing that must be repeated. Like drug use, serial killing is an addiction because the euphoric effects are only temporary and mask the underlying problem. So I guess that's the very long way around saying that the buffer is a transcendence point. It's the midpoint between two people merging. Not surprisingly, guess what's going to be coming up here soon in a minute? A potential narrative about the buffer, Abby, possibly running away, right? The buffer being removed. A little girl will hold her father's hand and think of him as the only man in her life. But as kids age and spend more unsupervised time with friends entering their teens, their close friends start to take over that role of being by their side all the time. We all know the plethora of teen movies to come out of Hollywood in which some hapless but likable high school student is obsessed with the hot girl at school, and while he's staring at her standing by her locker with the Chad of that same school, like the quarterback, his quirky quasi-loser best friend rolls up and says, "You have no chance with her. You should forget it. She only goes for guys like Chad." But he wants her. And we watch that movie because we know what it is to be that person, to want something we can't have. The Chad being partnered with the hot girl, while the hopeless protagonist is still partnered with his loser best friend, absent of romantic love, has been the backbone of too many teen stories to come. It's because usage of the platonic partner in the form of the best friend insinuates that when the protagonist's mother left his side as a child, upon his transcendence to becoming a man physically through puberty, he implemented a temporary placeholder, or buffer, for the woman who would eventually fill that spot. We do that through our friends. So the implication is that the Chad has matured and succeeded with girls his age, having transcended his childhood, while the protagonist is still unable. Until the protagonist is able to overcome the issues holding him back from getting the girl he wants, the best friend acts as a placeholder for the time he'd otherwise be spending with a girlfriend. And then, as the movie continues, the protagonist matures, and by the end, whether he ends up with that girl or another, we see the best friend is no longer at his side. It's her. So he has removed that placeholder and substituted romantic love. I see that as Abby's role in this bridge crossing. She is here to act as a buffer. If we think back to the phone call I mentioned my friend making for me to that girl I wanted to ask out as a teen when I was Abby and Libby's age, we can see that I utilized my friend as that same type of placeholder and buffer for doing the same thing. I wanted to insert this girl I had a crush on and extract my best friend, at least to a certain extent. I used him both as protection from getting hurt emotionally, aka as a buffer, and as a placeholder for the girl I wanted to insert by my side, since my sexual maturity turned my attention from my mother's affection to girls my age. Now, as a boy, I didn't have much concern for the possibility of a girl hurting me with anything other than rejection. And rejection hurts a lot, which explains why I had a buffer in that phone call. But for girls who are looking for boys, especially online today, you can get hurt, even murdered. Especially because girls are often attracted to the possibility of fixing broken boys who are struggling to become men. And yes, while some of those bad boys make for great stories you can never tell your kids and can light up your life with excitement, the truth is that some people of that sort are prone to violence, and specifically, violence against women. The man-child bad boy easily draws the affections of young women and girls because of one factor. Many of them had a father they couldn't fix in a way that made them feel loved. So they are excited about the opportunity to try again on a symbolic level. If daddy wouldn't love you at whatever time and for whatever reason, or even if you just felt like that, you go out and find a young bad boy like him who refuses to do the same, and you attempt to fix him to cope with the irreconcilability that your childhood is gone and you no longer have an opportunity to fix it, aka fix the father. Sociopathy implores physical manifestations of emotional holes that need to be filled with love, but since love is an emotional property that can't be addressed physically, what happens is that the mirrored version of the truth comes to bear. If you have a hole that needs to be filled with love, sociopathy dictates it can only be filled with the properties of physicality. Therefore, the perpetrator kills the emotional problem through physical means and literally fills the hole. But look what nature tells you. You're just burying your problems. In truth, they need light rather than darkness to bring healing from the trauma. So what I see here, from a psychological standpoint, at the end of the bridge, is that Libby had very likely been in contact with an older child molester posing as a good-looking young man or teen. Her behavior dictates that she seemed to be anticipating something in excess of the emotional value it had for Abby. She's out in front, taking photos, moving quickly and turning around, while Abby walks deliberately, head down, seemingly disinterested in whatever is taking place. What it looks like to me is that Libby, both out of necessity and comfort, and protection of course, brought her best, most trusted friend to meet the guy she had been talking with over the internet. When Libby snaps a photo of Abby at the midpoint of the bridge, we notice Abby isn't even looking at the camera. She seems to be concentrating on making sure each of her steps is perfect, something that indicates, like her friends have suggested, that she might not have crossed the Monon High Bridge before. So, if she hadn't done it before, but Libby had multiple times, and they were supposedly attached at the hip, it's pretty clear that Abby, in truth, had no interest in crossing that bridge, and probably because, like most people, she was afraid. Her behavior, in my eyes, speaks to a utilitarian purpose for being out here. This isn't for her enjoyment. She doesn't look like she's having a good time. She looks like she's doing somebody a favor. Libby is the one who seems excited. Libby stops to take a couple of photos along the walk over the bridge and still beats Abby to the end by a distance long enough that she turns around to film Bridge Guy and seems to capture a bit of Abby's sweatshirt in the process. Bridge Guy walks nearly the entire distance of the bridge in the time it takes Abby to walk halfway across. In fact, when she's halfway across, you can't even see him approaching yet. He has not even arrived at the bridge. So, basically, Abby's moving along at a snail's pace. Libby is moving like she's totally carefree, even stepping out onto that rotting old platform with no safety railing to turn around to get a pic of her friend. It's apparent she's moving with ease despite the risk. Abby is not. That's just a manifestation of what's going on here emotionally. Libby can't wait to get to the end of the bridge because love is supposed to be waiting on the other side. This bridge, symbolically, equates to her crossing over into adulthood where she'll meet the man who will take the place of her father, so to speak. But she's indulged a lot of risks to get to the other side where love awaits. Abby, who didn't have a phone and clearly didn't get catfished for that reason, is moving across this manifested bridge to adulthood with extreme caution, looking down at her steps, making sure she stays elevated and doesn't fall back down into the abyss of the past, aka her childhood, below. Meanwhile, Libby is like, let's do this. Risk? What risk? And she's just moving across very freely. Again, that's a manifestation of Libby rushing across to adulthood, and Abby is deliberately doing so. Now, what is Libby's emotional wound causing her to rush like this? In essence, absence of the father. She has daddy issues. All we need to do is look in the emotional mirror to find the reversed value leading to emotional truth. So if the issue is absence of the father, then the solution is his presence, the return of the father. That's what happens at the end of our evolutionary narrative. The father appears, the white light, meaning God. We finally know his identity. And if the father in question comes from the past, well, then the emotional story at play here dictates a man of that age will approach from behind them and follow them into adulthood to kill their childhoods. That's the manifestation of Libby's emotional issue. As her father reportedly missed time with her due to dissociation at a young age and later prison time, she's seeking the reunion of those two people symbolically, meaning through finding a romantic partner. But those people are gone. They're the past. This is now an emotional wound. It's a hole that needs to be filled. So we know this guy is going to both manifest the idea of a young romantic suitor and an aging man like her father. She expects the Chad, and by way of tragic fate, the reversal is that she gets the father. Why? She utilized that bridge to make a physical jailbreak into adulthood instead of maturing to that place emotionally. She did that simply because she wanted to get to the place where a guy she loved would love her back the way she deserved, something she clearly felt her father didn't do in his absence. But because she's manifesting a physical solution to an idea that requires emotional change, the universe, again, will deliver an ironic solution based in tragedy. Basically, if she wants a man to kill her childhood symbolically and goes about it through physical means, nature is going to accommodate in the worst possible way, which is through tragic fate. She wanted a man to take her away from the emotional pain related to her father and childhood. A predator seeking a child like that would come from the same background, meaning he has not emotionally transcended to become the father because of the abuse suffered at the hands of his own. Pedophiles see kids who are like them and pounce on that vulnerability. The narcissistic killer will believe the two need each other to perform their narrative to satisfaction. He needs someone to fill the role of a child like he was in the past and still is emotionally, desperate for the love of the father, so to speak, in order to be able to physically kill that thing in the absence of doing it psychologically. And he knows the victim wants to do the same, or else she wouldn't be talking to catfish chads online who are really older men. He knows she wants her childhood to die, and since that's what he wants too, he rationalizes that they need each other and this act equates to love. Again, that's why we have the narcissistic love-hate aspect, the wrath followed by mercy. He loves that child inside him and wants it to have peace, but also hates it and wants it to die. Those goals go hand in hand, ironically. If he kills that child inside him, wrath, then he and the child will finally know peace, mercy. This is a story about inadequacy, but specifically emotional inadequacy. A man is feeling emotionally impotent, meaning he does not possess the willpower to change, and therefore cannot make the bridge that crosses from the place where he's stuck to the place where he wants to be on the other side. We need to create a firm platform on which we can walk emotionally, meaning psychological stability rather than imbalance. In terms of sexuality, especially in the context of a man, this bridge is the equivalent of an erect penis. This man doesn't possess the emotional potency required to get it up, so to speak, or make a bridge on a psychological level. If he had been Indiana Jones trying to create the bridge of faith over a dark pit below, his first step would have taken him directly downward like a limp penis. So, if you were experiencing this emotional impotence, where in Delphi would be most symbolic of success in overcoming that physically? Well, it ain't called the high bridge for nothing. That high bridge, so to speak, is the physical equivalent of emotional ascension. It's saying this person has climbed to the highest heights and has crossed over into adulthood to become the father, but in a physically manifested way. And of course, this probably sounds ridiculous, but the reason a penis emits semen that is both equally white and transparent is that it represents the clarity of universal truth and the white light of the Father, God, or combination of all colors on the spectrum. We are reverse engineering our universe back to the point of origin, or universal truth, in which the bookends of the color scale, meaning black and white, which are actually not colors, merge to eliminate darkness. Our evolutionary pathway is a move from total ignorance, or darkness, to one of universal truth, or light, specifically the white light. And universal truth, of course, allows us complete transparency. So that's why white and transparent are important in the context of creation. So when we examine the buffer here, meaning Abby in the middle, what we should see is that her clothing perfectly represents the merger of the color scale in the context of blue and red shifted light. Of course, we do. Black and white merge to make gray, so Abby is wearing black and white shoes with zigzagged laces representing the switchbacks of evolution going back and forth from side to side like the platforms on the train tracks. Above them, she's wearing a gray sweatshirt, showing the merger of both. And then, to show the merger of red and blue shifted light, she's wearing blue jeans with a red shirt that would be more accurately described as burgundy. At the end of our evolutionary pathway, that sweatshirt would be white to represent the white light from the merging of blue and red shifted light. But since we are in the process of eliminating all of the darkness, that merger of black and white gives us gray in the middle. So let's get a little more ridiculous here. In the same way, semen travels across the bridge of the erect penis, and the white light releases creation in a big bang that has a female waiting on the other end of the bridge to receive that creation, the same will happen here, but in the context of death. The killer, meaning bridge guy, would be the father, so to speak, the one who is doing what in this act? Coming. No matter which context you use, that's what he's doing. So if he's coming, what do we know about light which is coming at us in the universe rather than going away? It's called blue shifted light. Now, look what Bridge Guy is wearing. Blue jeans, blue jacket. And again, in the context of creation, the bridge is a penis. But in the context of death, what instrument do we use to substitute for that? A gun. A gun is a stiff, straight line that releases red-shifted light, aka blood, instead of the blue-shifted light of creation, aka that which is coming, like semen, and brings death. So when Bridge Guy reaches the culmination of the bridge, it ain't going to be an ejaculating penis he whips out of his pants to connect with one of these girls. Instead, it's very likely going to be a gun. Or it could be any stiff, straight line that causes death. For instance, when Michael Myers walks around with his big, scary knife stabbing people, what he is essentially doing is manifesting vagina after vagina on the victim's bodies, into which he can symbolically return and find the safety of his childhood. Whether you use a gun or a knife, you're creating a hole in which you can insert yourself because the world dictates you can never go back to the past. You can never find the comfort of the mother's womb again. That's where we all come from. It's why men are left to stand outside it, begging to get back in, even if it means they can only pound on a door where nobody ever answers and must repeat it for the rest of their lives to cope. That's all we are, just people filling holes. One of the clownish things that religion does is it teaches us that God, or the Creator, doesn't create evil, and that evil is a product of choice. If you're a spiritual person, of course, you might very well believe that, which is fine, but science has long since proven that evil deeds are not derived from choice, they are derived from necessity. But because that truth conflicts with religious beliefs, we as humans have gone to the greatest lengths to legitimize things through absurd means. For instance, there was a time hundreds of years ago when evolving humans started to ask how it was possible that God created good but not evil. And a common response is that God had not created evil in truth, they said. He had created an incomplete palette of good, specifically meaning there was something inherent within the construction of the concept of good. You want to guess what it might be? Holes. We were told that there were holes in good, and within those holes is where evil manifested. God did not create it. So, what do we try to do? fill the holes. So if you're a sociopath who manifests the physical properties of these emotional ideas, a child inside you who refuses to die is one that you are likely going to kill, symbolically place into a hole, and fill that hole. When there is no hole, then the victim is often covered to manifest the filling of it. People killed and left in their homes are sometimes covered with sheets or blankets. That suffices to symbolize covering a big hole. Now, in the universe, specifically within the framework of infinity, or the infinite loop of time in which our universe exists, our evolutionary pathway culminates with the intersection of the seeker and the sought. Jesus becomes God. It's the moment of transcendence to becoming the white light. And then, with a big bang, like that orgasm we talked about, it all starts over again. Your respiratory system, specifically your lungs, have been designed to mimic this action of expansion and contraction through repetition, inflating and then collapsing. Think of a view of the side of the bridge again, with the circle that has two halves of the same hole with a line through center. The line is your lungs, aka the binary universe in a collapsed state, or the beginning or end of a breath, and the continuous expansion and subsequent collapse in between is existence. The universe expands outward like a breath in a big bang and then retracts. It goes from flat to inflating and back again, facilitating life. So it goes from a straight line to a circle, back to a straight line to a circle. That's how we get the straight line and the circle, or the one and zero of binary coding. So your emotional world works the same way in terms of a character arc. We have phrases like getting over the hump, or flattening the curve, or hump day for Wednesday in the middle. That's representative of the semicircle both above and below the bridge of your life. Your emotional character arc runs beneath, and your physical narrative unfolds above. Merging the disunity of the two to find unity, or your authentic self, is making a straight line from a circle. Your emotional and physical worlds must merge to reveal authentic self. That's flattening the circle, creating the straight line. That's why you're always hearing flatten the curve. In our evolutionary narrative, the authentic self is the creator, or God, the white light, or the transparency, universal truth, which reveals himself, or itself, at the end. So here, Bridge Guy is going to act like a burst of semen traveling down the binary chamber of the penis, representing our binary universe, seeking to release death instead of creation into his target by way of either the manifested penis in the form of a gun, or the same and by way of a knife. In the universe, we have black holes proven to be real, and also white holes, which we believe exist, but are not able to be viewed. The idea of black holes and white holes is really ridiculous, but the science behind it is fairly simple. A black hole is something that consumes light. If light goes in, it doesn't come back out. The white hole is the theoretical other side of that equation. If something goes into a black hole, it comes out the other side on a white hole, a place where nothing can ever enter. It's like this. If you were inside a vagina looking out, you would see light. But if you were on the outside looking in, you would only see darkness. You and I live in the outside world, so to speak, the binary universe in which disunity, first symbolized by a mother's physical separation from a child, applies to our reality. Once we leave her, we no longer have that view of the white hole from which we came and can't get back in there. So just think about men attacking women with guns, knives, penises, and all sorts of other straight lines, stabbing, shooting, and thrusting wildly in a desperate effort to manifest the emotional irreconcilability of being able to get back inside to the place where you can become whole again, aka unified. They try to go backward to the past because they can't transcend. The more passionate a man is about wanting to be unified with a particular woman, in a case where she wants the opposite, the more severe the totality of number of manifested vaginas he'll carve into her body with weapons. It's symbolic of his desire to get back inside. If a man is incredibly passionate about someone, he might stab or shoot her many times over, beyond necessity. The idea is to create as many holes as possible, and big ones, so she suffers the horror of a physical death that matches what he suffered emotionally. Those holes are going to cause death. A reversal. When it's over and the victim is dead, she will no longer have the ability to fill those holes. They will have consumed her like they did to her attacker emotionally. So again, Bridge Guy is going to say, guys, go down the hill. Going down the hill physically matches what happened to him emotionally. He went downhill. Now, how do we often define somebody who is unable to make the emotional bridge in front of their feet and is descending to darkness because of it? We say, they're falling, right? We talk about how far a person fell when they descended to darkness emotionally. So, we love stories about the rise and fall. So, how do you think that idea might manifest in this narrative? Well, apparently, according to Libby's sister Kelsey, when they searched that area where the girls went down the hill, she noticed something odd, something out of place along the way, which I'm sure other people saw as well. In the path leading from the end of the bridge down the hill, there seemed to be unsettled dirt in a sliding pattern, indicating somebody fell walking down the hill. If that in fact is from somebody falling, that is probably a manifestation of the perpetrator's emotional life coming to bear. And what it means, this fall, is that he's leaving the light and going to darkness. So in the fall, specifically in the physicality of the fall, the environment, we should see a symbolic rendering of the idea of leaving the light and going to the darkness by way of the fall. And of course, we get it. We see that this person has fallen, and when he falls, what does he push with his body out of the way? Leaves. So the leaves, right? He is leaving the light, they get shoved out of the way, and what's beneath that? The dark soil, the darkness. And so he's leaving the light for the darkness, he is falling. And that's what's happening emotionally. In this moment, he has literally just kidnapped two children with the intention of killing them. Up until the moment that he encounters them at the end of the bridge, the crime has not happened. But as soon as it does, we see the symbolically manifested narrative of him falling. We don't fall much further than this guy just did in life, and I think that's likely what happened here due to structural necessity. Nature is saying, this is what happened. Now, what would also happen in that instance and due to structural necessity? Well, now that the father has arrived, so to speak, meaning the guy who was supposed to be Libby's suitor, it's time to take the buffer out of the middle so those two can be together, right? Accordingly, this is where we get a rumor about Abby running away to safety, but returning to be with Libby because Libby was specifically what? Stuck. Stuck in the mud when she entered the abyss, the creek below, the dark waters of the unconscious mind. And without that shoe she lost in the mud, what does she become manifested as physically to match her emotional issue? Imbalanced. How does that impact her life? She can't move forward. She gets stuck there. And like Sonny Corleone at the toll booth, without a car behind him blocking him in, what does this mean? Her only option is to go back to the past. Why? Sonny's story tells us. Because you can't pass the transcendence point until there is emotional change. If they tried to run across the creek, it would be the equivalent of trying to cross the bridge into adulthood again. On an emotional level, the only way forward is to face the father, so to speak, by going back to the past. So that manifests here by having the buffer put back in place, at which point the girls are returned to the father, aka past, where he will physically kill them. Libby physically dies in the place where she had been living emotionally, and that's the secret to how easily the perpetrator was able to draw her there. It's simple. He'd been living there too. He knows what it looks like. And when you've been living in a place of emotional isolation, but suddenly discover there's another person out there looking for you in all of that darkness, someone just like you, who understands, that notion is intoxicating. Undoubtedly, that sentiment is the reason that Libby likely fell prey to a catfish who was seemingly a very attractive man on his facade, likely far out of her league, so to speak. It's because they clearly made a connection. Deep emotional connections sometimes overcome physical indifference. People want to be understood and loved for what's on the inside, right? If you were the ugliest person in the world, you'd want that because you couldn't offer physical beauty. And if you were the most beautiful person in the world, you'd want it because everybody only desired you for your beauty. Wherever Libby fell on that spectrum, I think it's clear she wanted that too. And the killer, when he was a child, desired the same but couldn't have it. It was a pipe dream. And so, as he suffered it in his youth emotionally, she would die that death physically. What most people are missing in these cases is that the perpetrator and victim are making an emotional connection so strong, it cannot be stopped. That's why I suggest that in this case, the perpetrator would not only bear some type of emotional similarity to Libby German, but also a physical one. He was projecting himself at that age onto her and placing himself in the role of his abusive dad. It's a twisted way of ascending to become the father. The killer gets symbolic revenge and puts the child inside him to rest. For now. So the big question is, did Abby and Libby know this man? Again, the sheriff was suspected even after law enforcement heard the audio in this case. That includes the audio we haven't heard, and the majority of the video we haven't seen. Apparently, they still believed Libby and Abby might know the man because they suspected him. If the audio and video had cleared that up, they wouldn't have reason to suspect him. Yet they did. Because of that, my guess is that it is entirely possible they knew their killer and obviously didn't identify him. Did he pull a gun after the point in time we saw him walking in the video? Or was there a ruse involved? Like I said, whether there was or wasn't one, we know it was over by the time Libby lost her shoe in the mud near the creek after descending the hill. In any type of legitimate situation, she would have been able to stop to get it. And look, yes, a good portion of the creek in that specific area seems to be part of a large sandbar, so to speak, but there is no question you're going to get wet crossing. There are deeper areas. It's February. Even on a warm day, that water is going to be ice cold. If a ruse was involved that suggested it was too dangerous to cross back over the bridge, and they had to go down the hill with this law enforcement officer, so to speak, whether he was a fraud or genuine, taking two girls through fast-running February water in Indiana is a good way to end up giving them hypothermia. I think it would have been crystal clear for Libby and Abby from the start that there was a problem. I think they were there to meet this person who they thought was someone else, and even though his identity was disguised upon approach, it was clearly not the person they had been waiting for. Except, tragically, and by way of ironic fate, it was. and they knew. Libby's act of intentionally filming this guy speaks volumes. I believe they were there to meet someone at the end of the bridge. They did. It wasn't the person they thought it would be. He was obviously a very bad man. That shock it produces, the utter sense of surprise, that moment, is the exact time in which these girls relinquished the last of their innocence to him. That's the allure of this power. That's what was done to him. As I said earlier, a member of law enforcement said he couldn't forget the look on one of the girls' faces, meaning her reaction to Bridge Guy approaching and realizing the truth. That's why Bridge Guy took the risk. Someone, specifically his father or father figure, did that to him in his youth at their age. This is his revenge. His father got to see the look on his face when he had this moment emotionally, meaning in the moment preceding the emotional death of his childhood. So he mirrors that to compensate with the physical death of the victim's childhood. He wants to see that look on their faces, the one that he knows was on his face when his father came and took his childhood, stole his innocence. It's intended to restore balance in a situation in which emotional irreconcilability disallows the indulgence of emotional solutions. Basically, you can't go back to your childhood, so you have to recreate it. He needed Libby to play the starring role of himself within that narrative. So we as the public don't truly know if Libby and or Abby ran and returned, or ran and were caught. Law enforcement might have a better idea of what happened, but sometimes the simplest explanation is the one that occurred. Is it possible someone slipped going down the hill, and that fall didn't affect anything? That person probably just got back up. Probably. The assumption is most often made that this perpetrator likely had a gun, so a situation in which the girls might run would be one where he lost control of them by losing control of the gun, rather than simply falling. It's possible he pulled a weapon, led them down the hill, they crossed the creek, and he subsequently committed the murders without any interference until the point of attack when the girls would be more likely to defend themselves. It's common to slip when walking down a steep hillside, especially at a time when old leaves from the fall and other brush act like a loose carpet for the forest floor in winter. So, ultimately, we don't have much information to go on in terms of what happened going down the hill and across the creek to the murder site. A member of law enforcement suggested they understood the first third of the narrative and the last, but the middle was a mystery. And that's because, in any story, the middle is the transcendence point, the point of no return, past which the ego dies and the authentic self emerges. Yet in a tragic narrative like this one, helmed by an anti-hero, the reverse is true. No change takes place, like Sonny at the toll booth. The ego lives on, as the protagonist, our killer, refuses to change emotionally. And his inauthentic self, or ego, remains intact as he submerges into an abyss below. He uses it for protective measures, to hide the place where it hurts. Now, think about this saying for a moment. What do people say when your ego starts to get too big? They say you have an inflated ego. That's the point. You're turning into the circle instead of the straight line. So again, he uses that ego for protective measures to hide the place where it hurts. Therefore, he takes the victims to the place where, quite literally, it's going to hurt. So much so that he's going to kill them physically to compensate for how he died emotionally. He takes them to the place where he died emotionally in order to kill them physically, which manifests as the hill, aka the hill going up into adulthood. Remember the circle? Down the hill, up the hill. Now, this is not a new concept. there were a couple of dudes indulging a father-son narrative that were called, what? The Hillside Stranglers, right? Angelo Buono and Kenneth Bianchi were family members who were 17 years apart. So Angelo played the role of the father, and Kenneth played the role of the son, and what did they do? They murdered young women, right? They stripped them nude, and then they would place them on hillsides where people would see them and be like, oh my God, they're shocked. You know, like, I can't believe what I'm seeing. And the whole point is the perpetrators are saying, this is where we died emotionally, and we're telling you physically. And of course, the bodies are nude for the purpose of rebirth. Babies are born nude, so symbolically, that's what they're trying to say. And of course, how does this happen? Well, they toss these people down the hill, right? And they remain at the top. And that's the point. Now, the place where killers in horror movies like Michael Myers, Leatherface, and Jason Voorhees endeavor to leave their victims suspended, so to speak, or floating, no matter the method, is between childhood and adulthood. Stuck there, physically grown, but emotionally trapped in childhood, like they are. It's revenge and also mercy. And so what you notice is these killers in horror movies often pose their victims. They do it for the shock value when people find them. What they want people to see is a dead, abused young person who will never grow up because that's what they're suffering inside and nobody ever cared it happened. When abusers keep the silence in the home, even if rumors escape, the abused child never gets to experience someone seeing what's really going on and how it has killed that child on the inside. They can't see it under those circumstances. So to tell them, killers often put the bodies in specific poses to freeze them in time. It's a manifestation of needing people to not only see, but experience and feel the shock of finding that dead child or young person inside the perpetrator's mind who wouldn't go away. It's basically a sculpture of their emotional pain delivered on the canvas of the material world with another person's body. That victim symbolically represents them. The idea is that a caring person close to the victim will see the child violently killed and trapped in time, proceed to be horrified and shocked, and wonder, what kind of a monster would do this to a child? Because that's what the predator has always wanted to know, and always wanted people to ask, in relation to his own situation when he was an innocent child. But clearly the secret didn't get out of the house, and though he seems to have escaped physically, this became the only way he could finally kill that child haunting him emotionally. The physical presentation is a manifestation of two things: what happened to the child and how they found peace. Physically, it's the physical equivalent of the perpetrator's emotional suffering from childhood dished out by an abusive father figure. He simply doesn't have the courage to tell us, except like this. As an artist, you show off your work, but if your art or your choice of catharsis from emotional pain manifests as murder, you can't be present at the gallery when you show it off. You have to remain anonymous, which is a cruel joke nature plays on an abused person seeking recognition. It's like, sure, you can have it, but the irony is that then you have to go to prison. Killers like the Zodiac want law enforcement to beg them to not hurt people because, as abused children, that's what they begged their fathers, the top authority in their house, to do, so it manifests in taunting law enforcement as dad. In criminal terms, for someone seeking catharsis through murder, law enforcement, again, is the equivalent of dad. And if you were in law enforcement, right, and there were people above you in positions to which you could not even aspire or positions you could not attain, you might feel even more strongly like that. So the Zodiac puts himself in the role of dad, so to speak, and says, hey, I'll blow up a bus full of children if you don't do what I say, because it's the equivalent of his father threatening him. Do what I say, and the monster won't come out. And that monster is the child who won't die. That is why they need to kill it. The monster was their father in childhood, but that childhood is gone, and so the abuse is now delivered by the child within, who simply will not stay dead. Like a zombie, it will keep coming back again unless you kill it by addressing one specific area of the body. The brain. If you kill a monster by way of emotional change, the monster dies. A zombie is a monster who used to be a person but lives after death. The idea of the undead, the inability to rest, and walking aimlessly in circles without purpose is fear of emotional transformation. The zombies are remaining the person they were even after they die, so that person, due to lack of emotional change, soon becomes a physically manifested monster. In society, we're using these zombie and vampire narratives to ease our fear of the inevitable human transition to AI, the fear of losing the person we were, our ego, to transcend to become something greater, our authentic self. And we're afraid because we know that transformation is going to hurt. That's why many of those transformation narratives, from werewolves to zombies to vampires, see the recipients of these physical transformations suffering badly during the change itself. It's a manifestation of what we go through when trying to change emotionally in a situation in which we have to leave behind the ego and indulge the emotional, authentic self. We fear what will become of us once we dispense with the facade we keep. So the monster to which they transform symbolizes the fear of what will happen if they indulge a particular change that disallows them from going back to what they were, such as transcending from childhood to adulthood or humanity's transition to AI. There is no going back from these things. They are the point of no return. We see it manifested in this man's crimes. He begins his approach once the girls cross the halfway point of the bridge. That's where he's been stuck emotionally, so it's where he begins to make change physically. He inserts himself as they cross the point of no return. When he crossed over into adulthood, his father was looming over his shoulder and closing in. He wanted them to feel physically what he did emotionally. Not dealing with his father's abuse by seeking catharsis through emotional means has left him crossing the border into adulthood with his father continually closing in until the point where he catches up. That's exactly where the killer was emotionally at the time, in desperate need of help and unable to bring himself to get it. Something in his life triggered an incident in which the ghost of his father was back on his tail and gaining, closing in with the intention to hurt him. He had no way to reconcile that idea emotionally, so he literally put Libby, and by default Abby, in that place where he was being followed and made them feel what it was like. The anxiety, the uncertainty, the panic. Oh my God, who is this man? What is he going to do to us? He wanted people to know what he suffered, but couldn't tell them. So he showed them. Because it's the child inside him that the ghost of the father chases, and not the man he seems to be. So he, as a man, does it to the girls. Now, again, we have that idea of floating or hanging. In A Nightmare on Elm Street, the teen bad boy boyfriend with a knife and a criminal record is one of the first teens to die because he is becoming a man-child, stuck between childhood and manhood. So the way it manifests when he's killed is that he's hanged inside a prison cell. It's where he'd been living emotionally, unable to transcend childhood by ascending to adulthood emotionally. Like Leatherface putting a teen on a hook they can't escape, he's hanging there, forever. Stuck. Floating, like Pennywise would say. This is exactly how the term hanging out developed. Young people in transition between childhood and adulthood are known for gathering without purpose, or hanging out, which came to be known as hanging out because you're going nowhere when you're doing it. A person might call during a football game and ask what his friends are doing at their house. They might say something like, "We're just hanging." It's when you're moving forward, building a bridge, that suspension matters. Otherwise, you're not moving. Floating and hanging are not the same thing at all. One involves a feeling of weightlessness, the other a tremendous burden. The killer in this story is stuck in a place between childhood and adulthood emotionally. In the context of this story and of the evolutionary architecture we've discussed, we understand that the place in which he succumbed was on the way up the hill into adulthood, as he was physically a man but ill-equipped emotionally and still a child. So half of his existence, in the form of the present, as an adult male, lives above the bridge on that physical character arc or plot that we discussed, while his emotional story, or that which is related to the past, unfolds down below. Up top, the midpoint of the bridge, is the symbolic point of no return. Down below, the creek serves that purpose. Crossing those troubled waters will resonate with the killer as crossing the threshold from childhood into adulthood. Water is most often used in a context of rebirth narratives because the womb, of course, is equipped like that. When a mother is about to give birth, her water breaks. The baby proceeds to leave that body of water as it transcends into the world outside. So when we seek symbolic rebirth, even religiously, it often involves a body of water, whether it's a baptism, someone being reborn, etc. In this event, the rite of passage in question, or rebirth, is this killer symbolically walking back through his adolescence, aka the creek, which lies at the transcendence point, or womb of transformation between his childhood and adulthood. The killer, as a teen the girl's age, died emotionally coming out of that difficult transition from childhood to adulthood, aka crossing the creek, specifically on the climb up the hill afterward, on the other side. He isn't equipped to go any further emotionally because that child haunting him inside acts like a psychological anchor preventing it. So what he intends to do is kill this child, Libby, and physically leave her in the place on the hill where he died emotionally, just like the hillside stranglers did to their victims. And then he is going to physically move on from the death of his childhood, symbolized by Libby's dead body, which he was unable to do emotionally. And so that means he's going to go up the hill, just like Kenneth Bianchi or Angela Buono would be at the top of the hill while tossing the body down. They're creating that situation in which the child or the past dies, and in its place, they are the father at the top of the hill. He plans to leave the dead child there to say he's finally moved on from being that person. He couldn't reconcile the issues emotionally, so he does it physically. He walks up the hill, manifesting the difficult, steep climb into adulthood. At the pinnacle of adulthood, we have something called death. So there's a graveyard at the top of the hill. A woman allegedly saw a man walking out of that graveyard around the time this killer would have exited that day. When he symbolically left his childhood behind with the murders and climbed the hill of adulthood to the pinnacle of death as the father in human form, or Christ, having walked on water, crossing the creek, he emerges from the graveyard in the form of the Father as God, or the white light, the One. There is nothing higher to which we can ascend. Walking out of the graveyard, he is symbolically resurrected from his human form as a deity. He, in his mind, has become God, the pinnacle of power in the universe. So again, it's not a secret that in 2019, at the Delphi Murders press conference, Superintendent Doug Carter specifically said, "This is about power." He knows it. Everybody knows it. We can see it. It's evident in this narrative. So if God is moving white light in its most essential form, and the point of this excursion was to finally separate the childhood from the adulthood, we should see it manifested in his escape to the type of anonymity the Creator enjoys. The identity of the Creator is a mystery. The killer desires that power as well, to be at the top of the hill. Accordingly, we learn the moving white light in this case is a Dodge Dart. Now remember how I said the father and son are two halves of the same whole or circle, and this killer wanted to separate them so that he didn't have one foot in adulthood and the other stuck back in childhood? Look how it manifests in the white light. Dodge Dart. The double D's, or semicircles, like the character arcs, are separated as two entities. The importance of this is that without constant separation of the two through transcendence, a person keeps going around in a circle. It's how we get the idea of being trapped in a never-ending cycle. The idea is that if you separate the two halves of the same whole, each offers a bridge across the abyss of the circle that lies below it. Suspension. Because you have to create that bridge, both in your physical character arc above and also in the emotional one below. So you want to create suspension, or the ability to float or stay afloat, in both halves of your life, which brings unity. But again, we're talking about suspension, and not the kind where you're stuck, the type where you float, where you're weightless. When the two halves are combined, you have a circle, and the bridge doesn't go across the top. It goes across the middle. If you travel it, you get stuck in between no matter where you go. We never end up on top this way because the bridge across only takes you to either side of a circle or cycle. It's structural necessity. But if you separate the two by transcending one for the other, indulging symbolic death and rebirth, either half of the circle allows a bridge on top. So it manifests in the double D's of the white light, the Dodge Dart, or white Dodge Dart. That's the bridge the killer wanted to cross emotionally and couldn't, so he manifested that desire at the Monon High Bridge by attempting to excise the lower half of the circle, or childhood, physically. He walked across that bridge on top of the semicircle, or character arc, went down the hill, across the creek, and back up the hill on the other side. The idea was to kill the child and separate that half of the circle so that he wouldn't be trapped in a cycle or hanging in between childhood and adulthood. If you don't do that, crossing the bridge only takes you to the same place, back into a cycle. Once he killed it, the only half of the circle remaining would be the father, the top half. That's what he wanted. So in the choice of the car, from the white light to the double D's in the semicircles, we see the manifested version of what it is that he wanted. So he takes that idea to its symbolic limit by indulging a narrative in which he subsequently climbs the hill after the death of the child, sheds his mortality through rebirth in the cemetery, walks out as the deity, and escapes unknown as the white light, or God, who makes everybody reverse engineer his universe to find the truth about his identity and why he did it. That's what we want to know. The narrative has to match our evolutionary narrative, because that's what we are. As we cruise into the twilight of Act 1 in the universe, meaning the ending of our childhood, humanity is not only on the precipice of colonizing space, but also extracting its mortality in favor of being AI. We're getting ready to transcend our current form through transformation, or metamorphosis. So in this era, a common form of suffering is mistreatment of kids. From pedophilia to beatings to neglect and murder, children suffer the wrath of the adults in this world. And that's the point. You go from total injustice to justice. That suffering won't exist in the future because there won't be any children. They are a technologically inefficient creation that will be made obsolete by necessity of evolution, just like the human in traditional form, and all of our evolutionary predecessors that led to what we are today. We are always becoming because the universe is simply comprised of moving images and nothing else. We can't do anything but change. So the framework of evolution is change, and more specifically, transcendence. And so the way something becomes an acceptable social change is when the suffering caused by what exists outweighs the suffering of what will be. So basically, technological movement or advance dictates that children, due to their deficient ability to survive on their own, are an evolutionary liability. They go from necessity in reproduction to liability in artificial replication. That's how AI will eliminate children, the same way the cars replaced horses. As evolution requires life to move faster, that which cannot keep pace is made obsolete. So at this time in history, that obsolescence is underway. In that light, there is a strong necessity for crimes against children, unfortunately, in the same way the desperate plight for control of women's reproductive rights is going to drive them to the inevitable conclusion of extracting the womb. Those things go hand in hand. No more kids. Injustice drives evolutionary necessity. It reveals deficiencies or holes that must be corrected or filled with transformation. Justice is achieved through transformation and not choice, because we are simply comprised of images. Horses were the recipients of some of the most horrifying and brutal deaths in the history of warfare against their will, but they became too slow and inefficient to have value on the battlefield, so now they have earned the justice of not having to die there. But in order to be saved from that horrible fate, they had to be proven technologically inefficient and no longer suitable for the purpose. AI will do that for reproduction. It will give way to artificial replication. There will be no more pedophilia. There will be no child murders. Women will not be raped and killed, because there will be no necessity for such suffering to precipitate change. Gender, or sex, will be extracted through the androgynous disposition of replicated beings that don't rely upon binary reproduction. That's the future, but it's a distant one. In the meantime, women and children suffer at the hands of men, and for those reasons, again, very unfortunately, and what they are specifically suffering is what our perpetrator feels here. The pain of becoming the father. That's what evolution is. Becoming him or it. That's what all of this suffering is about. We are becoming the father or singularity, and therefore the idea of women and children must become obsolete over time. The father, again, is the singularity. The one. At the end of the narrative, there is no room for anything else. Think of the circle with crosshairs again, like a gun scope. Then remove the circle, or the womb. You have two crossing straight lines, or ones, just like you see on the crucifix, depicting Christ's transformation. As they, the straight lines, have become redundant, like gender or sex in an androgynous world, those two ones simply become what? One, the one, God, the singularity, going from the circle and the straight line to just the straight line, the bridge. Creation is a bridge that leads from the place where we were born to the place where we'll be born again. In this story, the killer manifests that idea by beginning at the freedom bridge where the story is born, and freedom being what he's seeking emotionally. That's what we seek. Justice from injustice, light from darkness. He walks that evolutionary pathway, so to speak, to a place that, like the infinite loop, dictates the beginning is the end. So he starts at the freedom bridge, and to manifest that same idea of justice at the end too, he crosses the Monon High Bridge to meet a person named Liberty. The end is in the beginning, the infinite loop. We have liberty, or freedom, in both places on the bridge, but not in between. That's where he must suffer. That's where we must suffer. It's what we must do. We come from a place where we were once whole or free, and then spend the rest of our lives trying to get back to that place inside. So justice happens in our evolutionary narrative. The killer extracts all the women and children, and therefore, in the end, only one man, aka the one who was just reborn, remains. He's the singularity, or God. He's the white light in a Dodge Dart, having separated the two halves of the same whole, or father from son. It's what he wanted. Emotional separation from being his father's son, still trapped in that abusive environment emotionally inside his head. He wanted to be free of it. He wanted to be the father once and for all, to kill the abused child within. Okay, so I'm going to wrap it up there for this week, and I will be back with you next Tuesday for part 5. Thank you for joining me.